Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Now, can we just start by talking about Galileo himself? Give us an idea of his background.
Sure. So Galileo came from a family in which his father was a musician and indeed composed many pieces for the violin and developed a mathematical arrangement of the notes for his pieces. And so Galileo, I assume then, was well aware of the power of mathematics and its applications to music, and this seemed to influence his early outlook on life. And after his studies at the universities in northern Italy, he actually became a professor of what we would call now a professor of mathematics, first of all at the University of Pisa and then later at the University of Padua. And he quickly became rather burdened with debt. He had a growing family of children with his housekeeper. He had an instrument-making business that he ran out of his home. In fact, he also rented out rooms to boarders and supported a coppersmith and a number of servants running this large and rambunctious household, by all accounts. And he earned money not only from his lecturing duties at the university, but also by making his scientific instruments and indeed even casting horoscopes for a somewhat princely sum as a sideline that he charged money for.
Horoscopes. Now, there's one I haven't heard about Galileo before. Early versions of what kind of instruments as well?
Mostly scientific instruments, so measuring instruments, vernier, calipers, quadrants, protractors, even simple versions of what would become known as a slide rule for doing mathematical or arithmetic calculations. And that showed that he had a strong interest in scientific instrumentation that laid the foundations for his astronomical discoveries to come soon after.
Yeah. Now, he didn't invent the telescope as such, but he made improvements to it throughout history. People from all civilizations, of course, have looked up at the stars. But thanks to improvements that Galileo made to the telescope, you could see more. So what sort of development was important in the discovery of Jupiter's moons?
Well, that's a very, very key question. And in fact, Galileo became so skilled at making astronomical telescopes that for a long time, decades, in fact, if you wanted an astronomical telescope, this new invention, you had to get it from Galileo. So he heard that there was this gadget that was basically a fairground novelty but could also be used at the opera, that if you looked through it, you could see things up close because of the lenses in a tube that magnified the view. And I gather he sat down and thought about how could this possibly work. I don't know that he actually got hold of one. They were popular in Northern Europe, I believe. And he worked out from first principles with optics how to make a telescope himself using his own design. And I believe that he purchased spherical glass vases from the artisans in Venice, which he presumably then broke up and selected a suitably curved fragment, which he then polished himself. You needed a very good shape on the curvature to get a good image that was in focus and wasn't all blurry. And you needed a very clear glass that wasn't contaminated with iron or other elements that made it fuzzy, and by carefully shaping two pieces of glass, one for the front of the telescope and one for the eyepiece at the other end of the telescope with about a meter between them, even making the tube for the telescope himself, he finally had a working instrument. He was interested, I think, in selling the idea to the civic leaders as a for as possible military applications, for viewing ships far out to sea and figuring out, I guess, whether they're friends or foe or merchants coming into port, and so you can get ready. But in 1609, he turned this new invention of his to the heavens. And there followed a flood of remarkable new information and discoveries, including the moons of Jupiter and much else besides.
David Jamieson is my guest tonight, a professor of physics at the University of Melbourne. And this week in history, we are specifically remembering 7th of January, 1610, when Galileo observes four moons around Jupiter. But just before we get to that, the first thing he really turned this telescope, his telescopes to, was the moon itself, our moon. And what did he learn about our moon that we didn't know already at that stage?
Well, yes, that's a very good question, and it has a very remarkable answer. The moon obviously is a heavenly body, and it was assumed that anything that was in the heavens was somehow of a perfect shape and a perfect form, unblemished. And Galileo was quite surprised when he focused on the moon. He saw that the shapes that are visible to the unaided eye, the famous man in the moon and the mottled patterns, are resolved into craters and mountains, just like we might find on the Earth, which is definitely not a heavenly body as it was considered in those days. And to find that the Earth, that the moon displayed features that you could easily see through his telescope, just like features you might find on the Earth, surprised him greatly. And he was very careful to sketch what he saw through his telescope. And this was not an easy thing, actually, because the design of his telescope, although it magnified the objects he was looking at in the sky, it had a very narrow field of view, and it said that it was like looking at the heavens through a long drinking straw. So you could only see this tiny area. And I actually made a copy of Galileo's telescope myself so I could see what Galileo saw. And indeed, you can't even see the whole of the lunar disk through the telescope. You can see a small segment of it, and you've got to move the telescope around carefully to observe the whole disk of the moon. And I should point out, it's a particularly good time right now for viewing the moon. We have a full moon, and just a couple of nights ago, I was out with a friend who's a bird watcher, and he was showing off his new telephoto lens. And I said, never mind the birds, let's look at the sky. And we had a fantastic view of the moon, with a clear view of craters and mountains and long shadows cast by the mountains across the surface of the moon. And we were rewarded a little bit later with Jupiter, that rose about an hour after the moon came up. And indeed, through this modern telephoto lens, we could see very much the same thing that Galileo recorded on January the 7th of 1610, namely Jupiter with its four Galilean moons, as we call them now.
Yeah. George of Marlston has just sent through on the text line 0467 922 702. He reckons even with reasonable binoculars, 10 by 50 binoculars, which many people have, he can see the four biggest moons that are orbiting around Jupiter. He says, "I occasionally check them out on clear nights just to make sure the universe is functioning as expected."
Excellent principle. Yes, indeed you can. Binoculars, if you can hold them very steady so you get a nice steady view, you can indeed see the moons, the four moons that Galileo discovered back in 1610. It's an exciting to me, I find that a very exciting sight to see the disk of Jupiter escorted through the sky by its four Galilean moons. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Obviously, we've got to get to this very special night because this is why we're doing this on This Week in History. But just before we do, David, there you are recreating this, Galileo's telescope and trying to see what he would have seen and how he would have seen it. You've been, in a way, up close and personal with Galileo, at least via his writings. Can you share that story with us?
Yes, this was a really highlight of my interest in Galileo. I had the opportunity, thanks to my colleagues in the School of Physics at the University of Florence, who had a very good contact with the chief librarian of the National Library of Florence. And they knew about my interest in Galileo and his observations, and we had been corresponding about some interesting features, interesting things that he saw later on. And they arranged for me to visit the library in Florence, and I was directed through the public area of the library, through the closed stacks where people were looking at restricted, rare manuscripts, and finally into the ancient manuscript section right at the back. And I was sat at a little desk with a light, and into my shaking hands, the chief librarian placed Galileo's astronomical notebooks from 1610. And it was just a wonderful experience. This was an artifact that actually literally changed the world. The observations that Galileo recorded in his own hand in this notebook, which I was able to inspect, displaced the Earth from the centre of the cosmos, the geocentric model of the solar system and the universe, and set it in orbit around the sun. It was a thrilling moment.
I can only imagine, David, just what that is stunning. To have Galileo's notebook in your hands. Do they make you, just out of interest, do they make you wear gloves or something special for this ancient manuscript?
No, they didn't particularly ask me to take any special precautions. I had to be very careful because this is a 400-year-old book with handwritten entries in it in Galileo's hand. And by the way, I could sense the passionate nature of Galileo from the way he wrote. You know, he was very impatient when he wrote everything down in bold strokes of the pen, and in places, some nights where he was unable to make good observations, there was this crossing out, uncertain because of cloud, of course in Italian, where he was unable to make an observation that night. But you could see his determination and his excitement because night after night after night, he recorded what he'd seen in his telescope for years. It went on for several years of his watching Jupiter and the other things in the sky that he was interested in. It was an amazing record, accurate record of scientific observations for the first time.
Oh, how exciting. Well, then let's go to the 7th of January, 1610. Do we know what he was actually looking for? What was he looking for this night?
Well, I think he was very curious about what he might be able to see with his telescope. He'd already demonstrated its uses on the ground for seeing things far away, ships, etc., that I mentioned before. And I think he was just curious to see what he might be able to see with the heavenly bodies, which are visible in the sky every night. And so starting with the moon, the brightest and biggest heavenly body apart from the sun, he was able to see the things I described before. But when he turned his telescope to the planets, Jupiter in particular, on the 7th of January 1610, he got an enormous surprise because, as expected, he could see the disk of the planet Jupiter, resolvable in his telescope. It didn't just look like a bright dot like a star does to the unaided eye or even through a powerful telescope. But what he found when he observed Jupiter with his telescope for the first time, that it seemed to be passing a constellation of what was initially seen to be three little stars all in a row on that surrounded Jupiter, and they're in a straight line. Three, and he thought, that's very strange that Jupiter should be wandering through the sky and on this particular night just be passing in front of this row of three little stars all in a row. So he thought, I'll have a look tomorrow night and the following night and every night then for a number of years to see if I can figure out what's going on here. And sure enough, he found that eventually there were actually four little stars. Another one became visible because it had been behind Jupiter on the 7th of January. And soon he saw that there were these four little stars all in a row that were sometimes on one side of Jupiter, sometimes on the other. Sometimes there was one on the left and three on the right, or two on the left, two on the right. And he realized that these weren't stars, they were actually part of the Jupiter system. They were following Jupiter in its path across the sky. A planet, as everyone probably knows, literally means a wandering star, because to the unaided eye, the planets show a bright dot like a star, but they move relative to the real stars. So they wander across the heavens, of course, as they orbit. And he concluded that these four little stars that were always accompanying Jupiter in its travels across the sky must have been objects orbiting Jupiter, not the Earth. And this created a sensation, because up until then, the received wisdom was that the Earth was the centre of the universe and everything orbited the centre of the universe. All the planets and the sun and the moon orbited Earth. But here, for the first time, observations were made of objects that did not orbit the Earth, the centre of the universe, but orbited another planet in the solar system. So this was a very big discovery, and he observed them for years to plot the orbits and how long it took for each of the moons of Jupiter to go around in their orbits around Jupiter. So this was really a sensational discovery.
Yeah, and sensational. Yeah, sensational, yeah. Is a key word here, isn't it? Because, yeah, now we know, of course, about the repercussions regarding the Catholic Church, but and sorry to interrupt you, but just, you know, there's obviously is a scientific community of types as early as 1610. So how were his observations taken by the other scientists?
Well, Galileo was already fairly well known for his work as a mathematician and his work making useful scientific instruments, and also his lectures that he gave a few years earlier on a supernova that was visible in the sky. And he made some comments that this must have been very far away because it didn't display what's called parallax. The phenomenon that if you're looking at something close to you and you move your head backwards and forwards, the close thing seems to move side to side relative to things that are far away. But the supernova in the sky didn't show any parallax, so he concluded that it was a long way away. So he was already well known for being a keen observer of the sky and making original discoveries. But news of this new avalanche of observations from 1610, early 1610, the Moon, Jupiter, Venus in particular, and Saturn spread like wildfire. And they didn't have email in those days, of course, but the scientists kept in touch frequently by letters flying backwards and forwards all over Europe, and Galileo's letters were highly prized by the recipients and were often copied many times and then forwarded on to the recipient circle of colleagues. So the demand became enormous on Galileo to publish his discoveries, and so just a few months after he discovered the moons of Jupiter and many other things besides with his new telescope, he published a book, Sidereus Nuncius, the Sidereal Messenger, a messenger of the stars, on the 13th of March in 1610. So just a few months after he observed Jupiter, it was in print and began to circulate around Europe. And in fact, the English ambassador to the Republic of Venice managed to get hold of one of the first copies of this book and forwarded it on to King James I in Britain with a cover letter saying, this book is the strangest piece of news ever yet received from any part of the world. Such was the fame of Galileo and the interest in his new discoveries.
Now, Galileo himself is a religious man. He's a man of science, but he is also a man of religion. So talk about the fallout, because it's massive, isn't it?
It is massive, yes, Bern, it is massive. And like pretty much everyone in the 17th century, he was in Europe, in Italy, he was Catholic. He was well connected to the church hierarchy. His friends and correspondents were occupied high office in the church. It was very, very clear that the observations he made through his telescope, which, by the way, I don't think he ever considered belonged to him, they belonged to the sky, to the common property of anybody who looked at the sky could see what he saw. That he didn't need to be there to explain what's going on. Nobody had to take him on faith, but anyone with a good telescope could see exactly what he saw. And there weren't that many good telescopes around, by the way, unless Galileo could be persuaded to make one for you so you could see for yourself. And he was a bit worried that that the old geocentric model of the solar system, of the Earth being at rest in the centre of the cosmos, was not going to withstand the evidence in the sky that anyone could see. And he wanted, I think, to protect the church from making pronouncements based on biblical passages that could easily be proved wrong by an observer with a telescope. And I think that when the clerical authorities, the church authorities, saw him, read his books and interviewed him in Rome, they summoned him down to talk to him about what he was doing and what he was writing and what he was teaching that contradicted the scriptures, they told him to stop because they didn't want to upset the established order of things that everybody understood with something new that was dramatically new.
That was
very upsetting to him, I think.
One of the things that I don't think I ever clocked when we were, you know, studying Galileo at school or the like was the amount of time that passed between this first sighting of the moons of Jupiter and his first realization of, you know, that the Earth is not the center of everything before he is tried for heresy. Because that's 1633. It's a long time. Why does it take so long for it to say, no, you cannot say this now? He's been saying it for decades.
Well, yes, but he had been saying it. And of course, the idea that the Earth was a planet orbiting the sun, the heliocentric model of the solar system, was already well established, in particularly in northern Europe with Copernicus. The civil authorities in Rome were mounting a rearguard action against this. And Galileo was warned many times before he was finally placed under house arrest and forbidden to publish or teach anything more about the heliocentric model of the solar system. But he was warned he could still use it. He could still model the solar system with the sun at rest at the centre with the planets orbiting it, providing he emphasised it was only a convenient mathematical model that was useful for predicting the positions of the planets in the sky in the future. He wasn't allowed to say it was the actual geometry of the solar system. But Galileo was a very determined guy, and you can tell this by the passion with which he wrote down his ideas and his observations in his notebook. And he was not going to go quietly on this. He knew he was right, and he was determined to press ahead. But there's an important thing to point out, Byrne. We've been talking about his astronomical observations, but at the same time, he was doing a lot of experiments with what we'd now call mechanics. And he wanted to understand how the world worked. And he imagined doing experiments in a studio anchored to the surface of the Earth, playing musical instruments, rolling balls down inclined planes, watching butterflies, and then imagine doing the same in a studio on a very fast ship, zooming across the sea, propelled by a strong wind. And he considered that there'd be no difference in the observations in those two scenarios. And we know that when we fly, right? If you're sitting at the gate waiting to take off and you're offered a drink, you hold your glass up and the steward will tip the liquid into the glass for you. Or if you drop your phone, it'll fall down between the seat cushions and you'll have to have someone come and rescue it. And then, you know, a couple of hours later, you're cruising at 800 or 900 kilometres an hour, 10 kilometres above the surface of the Earth, and the steward comes past and tops up your drink and they'll just tip the liquid straight down into your glass. And if you again drop your phone, it'll faithfully fall down on the seat and disappear beside the seat cushion, and again you'll have to be rescued by a steward to find it for you so you don't damage it. So those two observations show you the way the world works. The laws of physics don't depend on how fast you're going. Whether you're parked at the gate or flying at 800 kilometres an hour, everything works exactly the same inside the cabin of the aircraft. And so what he had to figure that, he had to work that out first before he could displace the Earth from the centre of the cosmos, because the overwhelming evidence of our senses is that we're sitting at rest. We're not zooming through the cosmos at enormously high speeds. Everything's orbiting around us. But that's simply the way physics works. We can't detect the speed of the Earth as it orbits the sun unless we look outside and watch the sun rise and set. So that had to come first. And that actually was the first of the great relativity principles of physics. After that came Einstein with special relativity and general relativity. But Galileo got it started, that the laws of physics don't depend on how fast you're going, and therefore you can be on this planet moving at high speed around the sun and be entirely oblivious to the rate of motion. 30 kilometres a second, by the way, is how fast the Earth moves in its orbit around the sun. That's pretty fast, but we're insensitive to it because of the way the physics works, the way the world works.
30 kilometres a second. Remember that, people. I'm sure it'll turn up in what, if not a nightlife quiz, then a trivia night somewhere for sure. And you could say,
dizzying
I know
speed.
This to be true because Professor of Physics at the University of Melbourne, David Jamieson, told me it to be true. You've made what was going to be my final question redundant, so I'm going to change it slightly. I was going to ask how important was Galileo to the way we study science or the study of science today, but you know, talking about everything you have, we know that it's just phenomenal the impact that he had on
Absolutely.
How we view the world. So I want to ask you personally, how important is Galileo still in this day, 2026 now, David, to you as a physicist?
Well, Byrne, if I may give you a direct answer to that question in my own work, I'd like to draw a line from Galileo and the physics discoveries he made in the 17th century through Isaac Newton, who endorsed them and built further theories on top of what Galileo had already discovered, and then to Schrödinger at the beginning of the 20th century, who developed quantum mechanics that arose out of the ideas of Galileo and Newton and Emily de Chatelain and other people who contributed to the laws of physics and mechanics and turned them into quantum mechanics. And just recently, myself and my co-workers developed a device that will one day form the basis of a quantum computer made from dopants in silicon, and built what is a test of the Schrodinger cat that's dead and alive simultaneously, which was named as one of the five biggest and most significant developments from 2025 by the Institute of Physics in London. So I was very pleased to have that recognition in the top five by some measures that derived directly from the physics started by Galileo and then developed by everyone who came after him. That's at the heart of our device, that same observation that the laws of physics don't depend on how fast you're going, and a few other things besides, obviously, when it was turned into a quantum mechanical version of the ordinary classical mechanical version that Galileo wrote down, that is still a very important principle, the most important principle in all of physics today.
I feel as if I should have had you on to talk about your own work at this rate, David, and perhaps that's a conversation for another night. I'd love to know more about that device. You have been a delight to have on This Week in History, as we have discovered yet again just how amazing Galileo Galilei was. And we were looking at the 7th of January, 1610. You have seen The Notebook, which still blows my mind completely. And it's just been wonderful to have you on Nightlife. Thanks, David.
Well, Bern, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Galileo. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.